All right, it is 1 p.m. Eastern, so we are going to get started for today. I'd like to formally welcome everybody to today's webinar, and I'm going to go over some housekeeping rules and reminders while we're in Zoom webinar, and then we'll get started with our content. So, some housekeeping rules for today. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clueinn for those not able to join us live. The Clueinn training page that brought you here today offers the slides available for download, as well as all of our trainer bios and information. I'll be putting the Clueinn training page link in the chat just as a reminder for everybody in a moment here. We ask all of our attendees to please use the Q&A box to ask any questions, make comments, or report any technical problems that you encounter during our training today. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through the training, as well as at the end of our modules today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form and click a box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be emailed to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Cluin. Some background on ITRC. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website where you can find out more about the teams available for registration and how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's training, Contaminants of Emerging Concern Identification Framework. This is an introduction to the ITRC online resource produced by ITRC in 2023 of the same name. On slide number five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them served as volunteer members on the team and helped to support this training that we are proud to present today. At this time, I am going to hand it off to our first trainer, Kim Nimmer, from the city of Raleigh, North Carolina, to get us started. Kim, when you're ready.
All right. Let's see, do I have, oh, I do have control. All right, great. Thank you, Devin. So good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are. My name is Kim Nimmer, and I'm pleased to be with you today. I will lay the foundation for my co-presenters by providing an overview of the documents that the CEC team has produced and that are available on the ITRC website. So this graphic summarizes the Contaminants of Emerging Concern, or CEC, framework and the documents developed by ITRC and will serve as a navigational tool during our presentation today. The white paper provides a summary of the issue and why it is important to consider CECs in the environment. The white paper was developed to be used by management-level staff as it covers the overall approach and identifies potential challenges with developing a CEC program. More specifically, the white paper addresses factors that may influence a state's ability to address CECs, current CEC programs and approaches, and a new framework for identifying and monitoring CECs. The ITRC CEC team also developed a series of four fact sheets. The fact sheet addressing monitoring programs highlights which existing monitoring programs have data available on CECs in the environment or that can be used as a template to develop a monitoring program to gather more data on CECs. The fact sheet for the identification of key variables examines the questions, how do I evaluate or understand data on the CEC's occurrence, exposure, and potential to cause harm? What information would be needed to start making decisions on prioritizing chemicals detected in the environment? Key variables to consider when evaluating potential toxicity and exposure. schemes for interpreting variable information, and a case study is also considered. The Identification of Analytical Methods fact sheet presents information on how to identify and, if possible, quantify CECs in the environment, especially if there are no known analytical methods to use, individual chemical compound analysis, analytical methods for chemical classes, methods for biological contaminants, and analysis of particulates. The Risk Perception and Communication fact sheet considers how to communicate information on CECs to the public and stakeholders in a timely fashion, risk communication basics, risk communication considerations and challenges specific to CECs, and lessons learned. And lastly, it should be noted that the fact sheets are not intended to be used as a flowchart or in a linear process. The fact sheets provide different information that can be used as part of a CEC program and should not be referred to, or should be referred to as needed, but not in any particular order. All right. So the ITRC CEC team developed its CEC definition as follows. CECs are substances and microorganisms, including physical, chemical, biological, or radiological materials known or anticipated in the environment that may pose newly identified risks to human health or the environment. When considering the overall scope of what the framework would address, the team evaluated the three components of the CEC term and thought about which elements of contaminants, emergence, and concern would be emphasized. First, the term contaminants was originally thought to be synonymous with chemicals, and the team's name was originally going to be Chemicals of Emerging Concern. However, the team decided to use the term contaminants to be in alignment with the definition in the bipartisan infrastructure law, especially considering the revolving funds provisions, which will be discussed further in the next slide. This alignment in terminology also allows for the inclusion of physical, radiological, or biological sourced issues. Next, the term emerging is somewhat subjective, and there was much debate amongst the team as to what is emerging versus what has already emerged. And along those lines, we'll address known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, etc., later in the training. And lastly, the term concern focuses on human and environmental health risk as informed by the potential for exposure, potential hazards, and fate and transport properties. The ITRC CEC framework is intended to be a technical document, and its key variable decision tree leverages technical parameters to aid decision making. So as mentioned in the last slide, the CEC team's definition aligns with the language provided in the US EPA Memorandum, Implementation of the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Provisions of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, or Bill, dated March 8, 2022, which provides guidance for obtaining funding to address CECs. It was purposefully chosen because of the funding available to local governments through this new federal law. And note that even though the definition includes physical, chemical, biological, and radiological materials, the focus of these guidance materials is on chemical contaminants. Biologicals and radiologicals are not included. However, biologicals are the focus of the ITRC CEC team that is underway and hoping to publish materials in 2025. So we're back to the framework slide, which we will use throughout the training as a transition between the white paper and the different fact sheets. We are now going to start with a focus on the white paper that was developed by the CEC team. So let's start with considering why a CEC framework is needed. Regulatory agencies and the regulated community continue to be challenged by the ability to identify and address chemicals of emerging concern, even as the science of chemical testing advances and new information on chemical exposures and potential toxicity develops. The emergence of chemicals discovered during widespread monitoring with little or no toxicological data to put the risk and what does this mean into context is likely to continue. Working to identify and address CECs presents new and diverse challenges to states and regulatory agencies. In addition to insufficient data and staff expertise to characterize and address CECs, many states do not have CEC monitoring programs established to start collecting the data needed. Another challenge is presented by the fact that validated laboratory analytical methods have not been developed for the thousands of CECs that are or may be present in different environmental media. Finally, information and a framework are needed to help agencies evaluate and prioritize CECs and to provide assistance with the challenging task of communicating with the public and other stakeholders about the risk of CECs when there are so many unknowns. Trying to anticipate and or identify chemicals that may emerge as contaminants of concern in the future and in the timeframe demanded by the public can create a new and different set of challenges. In ITRC's CEC white paper and four associated fact sheets, we provide a framework for a process to identify, evaluate, and respond to contaminants of emerging concern. The process is based on approaches used by other regulatory agencies, is peer-reviewed, and allows for a stepwise process that can be tailored by individual regulatory agencies to fit their specific needs and requirements, including their unique situations, such as political and organizational structures, environments, and resource availability, including funding capacity. So in the end, states are likely to be faced with the potential need to identify and address hundreds of chemicals present in the environment. Through the process developed by ITRC's CEC team, states can effectively and efficiently determine which chemicals should be a priority based on the available toxicological and analytical data. The United States Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, was most recently updated in 2016 and requires the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to maintain a database that identifies approximately 80,000 chemicals that are considered to be active in the environment, excluding non-chemical CECs such as radiologicals, biologicals, and microplastics. Current state regulatory actions commonly focus on a limited set of chemicals in the hundreds compared to the thousands of chemicals currently produced, imported, or used in manufacturing. In addition, there is limited exposure, toxicity, and fate and transport data for most of these chemicals. For example, US EPA and states have developed scientific positions on human health effects for only several hundred compounds. This lack of information makes it difficult to track and eventually regulate these chemicals to protect human health and the environment. Given these conditions, it is understandable that addressing the other chemicals potentially present in the environment can be a significant challenge for state regulatory agencies from both a data and resource availability position. So this framework was designed to provide our primary audience of state government leadership with guidance regarding how to identify and prioritize emerging contaminants to timely incorporate regulation and prevent negative impacts to human health and the environment. The framework is intended to be useful whether or not a state has a CEC program. The four fact sheets were developed from the key concepts determined by the CEC team to be vital to the structure of a CEC program. To support this process, the white paper and the four associated fact sheets provide a framework that state environmental or health agencies can use to develop a CEC program. Overall, understanding and monitoring CECs can provide the information necessary to allow states to take corrective and regulatory action, ultimately safeguarding public health and the environment. This graph is from a paper that represents a bibliometric analysis of peer-reviewed scientific literature on emerging contaminants published from 2000 through 2019. The definition of emerging contaminants used in this study was broader than ITRC's CEC definition. The study included naturally occurring, manufactured, or man-made chemicals or materials found in the environment whose toxicity or persistence is likely to significantly affect the metabolism of a living being. However, the study and graph are illustrative of the rapidly increasing awareness, interest, and scientific study of emerging compounds. The last 5 years of this study, from 2015 through 2019, show a substantial increase in journal publications, more than doubling from around 400 to approximately 1,000 publications on CEC research annually. The United States, China, Spain, Italy, and Canada were the top five most productive countries in terms of the number of published works. According to the frequency of author keywords, the main research topic addressed by the researchers was the occurrence of pharmaceuticals and personal care products in wastewater. In addition to scientific publications, the increasing regulations and the development of CEC programs reflect a growing interest in CECs. So now we're going to shift from the white paper to the four CEC fact sheets. We'll first take a look at the CEC monitoring programs fact sheet, which presents existing monitoring programs that may have available data on CECs in the environment or that may be used as a template to develop a monitoring program to gather more data on CECs. So now I would like to welcome Carol Stein, EPA Project Manager Emeritus, to take a look at the CEC monitoring programs fact sheet. Carol?
Thank you, Kim. I'm now going to discuss the CEC Monitoring Programs fact sheet. It presents information on existing monitoring programs that can be used as examples for developing your own CEC monitoring program. Oops, I went too far. Sorry about that. Just coming back. Okay. So the CEC monitoring program's fact sheet consists of two separate components, an Excel table and an instructional narrative on how to use the Excel table. Okay, look. So a portion of the Excel table was enlarged for this slide. As you see, the table shows representative programs from state, federal, local, international, and other organizations. Each row of the table is dedicated to a specific organization that has a monitoring program in place. If an organization has several monitoring programs for different environmental media, a separate line is dedicated to each of those programs. And then the columns of the table show the details for each program. Each column can be sorted and filtered, and blank cells show they indicate that there's no information that was identified at this time, in the tip of the table. Okay, so can we go on to the next slide? Okie doke. So here's a quick look at the 11 columns in the CEC monitoring programs table and what each column contains. Just gonna leave it on the screen for a minute if you want to take a look. Okay. Alrighty. Okay, so there are 17 types of programs covered in the table. They include environmental media as well as some health monitoring programs. The scope of the fact sheet includes just the programs noted here. These programs can be found with a drop-down menu on column D of the table, and then the corresponding environmental media can be found on column F of the table. Right. So, please note that the fact sheet does not include the types of programs that are listed on this slide because these types of programs are either outside the scope of the CEC team's mission or outside of the scope of the information that was collected for the fact sheet. Take a look at them. All righty. Okay. Also, please keep in mind that there are a few limitations to the fact sheet and table. This is because CEC selection criteria for establishing CEC monitoring programs are not universally applied to all federal and state CEC monitoring programs. For example, some states and other organizations no longer consider certain contaminants to be CEC because they already have regulations in place for these contaminants. In these cases, the organization already might have a monitoring program in place for the contaminant, but the program is not listed on this table because the organization doesn't consider the contaminant to be CEC anymore. Okay, and then a second item is that a state or other organization might not identify a specific contaminant for monitoring under its CEC program because the contaminant is not considered to be a key variable of concern within the jurisdiction of that organization. So those are some reasons why certain items would not be included on this table. Okay. So we encourage you to visit the CEC, the ITRC CEC framework document online to view the monitoring programs and fact sheet and the tutorial on how to use the fact sheet. We hope this will provide you with useful information for formulating your own CEC monitoring program. Also, please note that drinking water data are normally more available than other monitoring media for exposure point protection. Finally, please note that high priority CEC, such as PFAS and monitoring media, are more likely to lead into the development of CEC monitoring programs than other factors. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so now we're going to transition to learn about the key variables fact sheet. And I would like to welcome Jose Zambrana of EPA's Office of Research and Development, who will be discussing key variables.
Thank you so
So
much,
take it away,
Cheryl.
Jose.
Appreciate it. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Jose Zambrana. I'm with the US EPA Office of Research and Development. And it's an honor to be one of the trainers today and glad to have worked on this team. Just one quick disclaimer, although I work for the EPA, my participation here is voluntary, and these are my own views and not the official views or policies of the EPA. Okay. So we're going to talk about the key variables fact sheet. And this is really going to help us answer a couple of important questions. Mainly, how do you or how do I evaluate and understand data on a CEC's occurrence, exposure, and potential to cause harm? And then what information would be needed to start making decisions on prioritizing chemicals that are detected in the environment? So some of the information that the fact sheet provides are key variables to consider when evaluating potential toxicity and exposure. We talk about different schemes for interpreting variable information. And also we have a case study, which we will present today. So the fact sheet has, maybe at its core, a logical flow chart for evaluating CECs. And we anticipate that it'll look familiar because it's based on key risk assessment features, just toxicity, occurrence. And so we use the risk paradigm to organize the flow chart for CEC evaluation. It was developed by the team. And we will be going through it today. The different variables are chosen with regards to evaluating risk based on exposure and toxicity, as I said. It also considers things like bioaccumulation and other sort of key factors. We want to know what information resources are available. So where can we find this information? Good scientific information is important to reduce uncertainty and improve our evaluation of risk. As you move through a process to evaluate a CEC, it is good to always ask, is the available information that you have at hand sufficient to make an evaluation? And sufficient is going to depend on your own program's requirements. And then, of course, it's useful to have tools to help prioritize and interpret CEC data. And we have some of that in the fact sheet. So, why evaluate key variables? Well, as we've already talked about, there are many chemicals in the environment. They emerge when substances are used in the built environment, and then they're released through activities such as production, use, disposal, and then end up in the environment. So, how do we address this when the public has concerns, and when key questions arise? It can be challenging to know which of these should we focus on, which really need to be addressed. Sometimes an event may lead to more attention for a chemical. I'm sure many of you have experienced that. And then the public concern grows, and then there's new information about the substance. Oftentimes, there's not a lot of information in these situations. So we are going to focus on chemicals here that can be measured in the environment and for which we are focusing on direct effects on human or ecological endpoints. That's important. We're not considering maybe indirect effects that could come from other kinds of situations. Okay, so let's talk about what actually is covered in the flowchart. So I talked about exposure and occurrence. We start there. And again, the image there is not meant for you to see it. If you go into the fact sheet, you'll be able to see it very nicely and follow it through, just kind of pointing out what's in that big flowchart. So we start with occurrence and exposure, we move to toxicity, and then we cover fate, transport, and chemical behavior. Why do we start with exposure and occurrence? Well, it's really important to know you have to begin. What's happening in the environment? Is there actually exposures taking place? Drinking water resources can be very sensitive because of the risk for human exposure. We look at then health effects, and are they directly related? How much information do we have? And of course, these key variables come into play in terms of how the CEC behaves in the environment. Is it persistent? Is it bioaccumulative? Is it mobile? Fundamentally, as I said, we're going to ask ourselves always, do we have sufficient data? Are we concerned with the amount of data or its quality? We may need to consider degradation products. We may need to consider cross-media concerns, multiple media concerns. And our goal, the whole goal to go through this, is to be able to put this given CEC into a bin. Is it a low priority? Is it a medium priority? Or is it a high priority? And we'll talk a little bit about what that means and why it's useful. So, low priority, medium priority, high priority. You see here that the flow chart helps you get to maybe where a given CEC that you're evaluating might land according to your program's requirements. This is really meant to help inform the next steps for evaluation and decision making. As mentioned, those decisions are based upon some kind of factors that influence the risk. So, okay, let's start with low priority. If at the end you put something into the low priority bin, what does this mean? Well, it means that there isn't a significant concern, that you don't need to do any follow-up monitoring at this time, and that you're open to new information. If new information comes across your desk, then it might warrant a consideration again of where the CEC might fall and if it may needs to be a medium or a high priority. Let's actually talk about high priority, and then we'll come back to medium. For a high priority, we have something that there is widespread or significant concern, where we want to expand monitoring and where we want to do additional risk characterization and potential rulemaking. So, medium priority. Medium priority doesn't necessarily mean that, well, it falls between low and high. What it means in this framework is that we need more information. We can't quite put it into the low or into the high just yet. There's enough that we have, but also uncertainty that we need more. So we need more information for prioritization. We should continue monitoring, and we should actively seek out new information that can inform the need for additional characterization of risk. What's really important that we want to emphasize here is that working through this process requires professional judgment to weigh different factors and various evidence. things like that you probably have to consider compound classes, mixtures can emerge as CEC, new data can trigger the reprioritization. And of course, having to come back to things periodically to make sure that they're in the right bin. Okay, so let's just summarize each of these. We'll go back to the start here. So the first criteria, we start with occurrence. Occurrence is where is the CEC found? If it's identified in groundwater or surface water that are used as drinking water resources, this is really important. It often becomes a priority because of direct human exposures through the use of that water. So that's often the first source assessed, but circumstances can vary. Occurrence in soil where there are sensitive populations, such as children, are often considered. A CEC that may be bioaccumulative, such as in fish, might call for a key approach, or if it's in consumer products, can lead to a number of exposure scenarios. So this is where we ask ourselves, is it in multiple media, or is it in media with sensitive receptors? And then we ask ourselves the question, has the previously identified CEC been identified in a new medium? Is there some kind of new pathway that hasn't been identified before? Ecological exposures raise similar questions about the mobility of CEC exposure for sensitive species, but of course also potential concerns for biodiversity. Okay, toxicity. So we ask, what is potential health effects, either human health or ecological effects? For many CEC, this is where information, there's information about the chemical sometimes, characteristics, but very little on its toxicity. Or the toxicity data that we have is limited, or it's of a type that is not normally used for any federal or state risk assessment. So data, of course, needs to be vetted to determine whether it can provide adequate assessment of human health or ecological risk and be used to develop toxicity values. So what's always key here is to provide clarity and transparency about your approach. Acknowledge always your assumptions, acknowledge uncertainty. Always asking ourselves, are effects significant? Do we need to develop or estimate toxicity values? And also being keen on, are there new exposure routes that need to be considered for toxicity? The sort of issue of this chemical, now there's a new exposure route that often prompts something becoming a CEC because now there's this exposure route that hadn't been considered, and then we need to go back and do and consider the toxicity situation there. Okay, and then the last bin here is physical chemical properties, so things to consider. We're looking at things that might inform fate and transport and chemical behavior. For instance, does the CEC persist or remain in the environment? And what media are affected, and what are they? Air, water, soil, some combination. Is there a freshwater environment, a marine environment? Is it a bioaccumulating through the food chain? This can be really, really important. Also, other properties such as how it degrades, or does it form other products or degradation products that need to also be considered? Does it have unique characteristics that affect its transport? Is it a foam? Is it amphiphilic? So sometimes the information is available, and sometimes it needs to be estimated. And so this will frame how it's considered. Okay. So to summarize, we have in this part of, in this fact sheet, a flowchart to consider how key variables inform prioritizing CEC, low, medium, or high. We have key questions that need to be considered on occurrence, key questions on toxicology, and key questions on physical chemical properties to inform fate and transport and chemical behavior. In the fact sheet, there are resources that help inform answering these questions, where to find information on toxicity or where there are resources to estimate it. where there are where you can find information on different fate and transport properties. We highlight key questions for evaluating data sufficiency. We have information on schemes to interpret these variables. So the document doesn't present one way of doing all of this. It doesn't sort of say if you answer this way and this way and that way and you add it up, then this is what it is, low, medium, high, and this is what you should do. That's not what this does. This is meant to walk you through a process when you need to evaluate, always judging it against your own program's requirements. That being said, there are some frameworks out there in the world that do take all this information and put it into a framework of how you might consider it, how you might actually put things into different bins. So we do provide some information on those frameworks if you're interested in those. And then we have a case study. So we kind of walk through a case study in the document, and we are going to be walking through a case, that case study today. Okay, speaking of which, let's go ahead and do that case study. So this will be a little interactive. So maybe prepare to type some things into a poll, but it's not coming just yet, but just be ready. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to present a case study. It's a hypothetical, and it's meant to illustrate how this framework and how this fact sheet works. So we're going to present a scenario. Okay, so here we go. So here's our scenario. Again, this is hypothetical. So you get a call in the middle of the night. Maybe this has happened to you, or you wake up the next morning and there's all the press is out there with the vans, and there's a chemical leak, or people are worried, or this or that, and there's suddenly a public concern. So, what do you do? So here we have a situation where we have a CEC, potential CEC, was initially detected first as a TIC, tentatively identified chemical contaminant, and then confirmed with the standard. So this was in our scenario, it was detected in the wastewater at an industrial property. We also find that this CEC is detected in a property well that's used for drinking water at the worker site. We find out that the CEC is a component of a solvent. It's an intermediate in pesticide production. It was detected in all but one sample from the drinking water well. We do confirm workers are drinking this water, so there's a direct exposure. The extent of the contamination on-site, off-site is not known. Soil ambient air concentrations of the potential CEC are not known. Volatilization from groundwater to indoor air pathways requires evaluation. We don't know that. Potential CEC is a solvent used in some caulks, paints, and coatings, and found in some fabric stain removers. It's possible that this chemical could migrate into indoor air. And further evaluation of its hazard, physical and chemical properties, presence in other media would be required. From that standard, we confirm that this is a chlorotrifluorotoluene. And so that's our CEC that we are dealing with. One quick thing is you do a quick search and find through the European Chemical Agency that this chemical is used in consumer products such as coating products, inks, and toners. It's used as in the manufacture of other chemicals, machinery and vehicles, plastic production and mineral products. It's used in scientific R&D, and it's used as an intermediate step in manufacturing of another substance. And release to the environment can occur from industrial use or can occur from indoor or outdoor use as a processing agent. Okay, so that kind of is the scenario. What we kind of want to do is sort of do a poll now. Hopefully this will work. So Devin's going to put up a poll. So, what would you do? What information would you try to seek out first? So, just whatever comes to mind, go ahead and type it in. Let's think about if you were encountered, if you received this sort of phone call in the middle of the night, what information would you need? Okay, you can go ahead and close the poll. So it's possible that some of the things that you thought of were some of the things that were presented in sort of the scenario information. So some of those that I covered, so I'm not going to read all the answers. I just wanted to prompt your thinking on this. Was the kinds of things you might do and calling up the company, finding out some of this information, finding out things about the workers, finding out anything you can about the site. Is there anything else you can figure out in terms of site characterization? Anything you can understand about this chemical from searching its properties, where it can go, what pathways it can go? Okay. And I just covered all of this before, but again, so this is this kind of builds on the scenario, the kind of information that we have in order to do our evaluation. So, okay, say that's everything that we have, everything that I shared. You've been thinking about what you feel like you need, what we have for the scenario. Let's go ahead and step through the flowchart and see where we land. Okay, so this is a little bit of a zoom in on this part of the flowchart, the first part. We have the CEC. We're going to now go through the criteria. So let's go through it together. Okay, so we're going to look at this first box. Has the CEC been identified in groundwater or surface water? And just answer it in your own mind. We're not going to do a poll. Was it in groundwater? Raise your right hand wherever you are if you say yes, left hand if no. Okay. Groundwater was a yes. We did hear that in the scenario. Surface water, no. That information we don't have, or we haven't seen that. Okay. Let's go to the next question. Has the CEC been identified in multiple media or media with sensitive receptors? So think about for a second what you might answer. And let's see what we got. Okay, so we did say that soil, we don't know. Ambient air, we don't know. Indoor air, we don't know. Wastewater, we do know, because that's where this all started, in sort of the wastewater stream. Okay, and then we'll go to our next question. Has previously identified CEC been identified in a new medium because of a new pathway? And in this case, we don't have any information here right now. This wasn't something that we knew before, and now it's suddenly something, a new pathway. So we're just going to put not applicable here. Okay. So a really important thing about how this whole flow chart is put together. There isn't, again, some kind of like, well, if you answer yes twice or no once or this or that, it's going to point you in a certain direction. That's not the case. This is meant to step you through a logical, a series of questions to ask yourself when you're evaluating this. So make sure you get to answering some of these key questions. Sometimes the answer is we don't know. Once you sort of ask yourself these questions and see what data you have, sorry about that. There's a box there that said, are there sufficient data to evaluate occurrence? So do we think that we can proceed, or are we really lacking the data that our program requires in terms of its quality to do this evaluation? If we think we have enough data to keep going through the evaluation, then we can go on to the next step. So, as I said, data sufficiency is based on your program's requirements. We're not dictating what that may be. If you don't have enough data, you would need to collect it. If you feel like, okay, we have enough data to sort of say, you know, let's keep going, we have some key pieces of information, then you can almost clearly answer whether it's a low priority, because if all your data shows that there is extremely limited or no exposure, no occurrence, if there's no occurrence, no exposure, then probably a low priority because there would be very little risk. Again, it would be based on your program's requirements. Or there might be something enough here that is of sufficient concern to continue with the evaluation. So for this case study, what we're going to do is we're going to keep going. We're going to say, the occurrence data that we had with the di different detections against the standard, we know what it is, where it was detected in the sources, in the source that's used for drinking water. It's sufficient to continue with the evaluation. So we're going to move on to the next step. Okay, so now we're on to the toxicity part. Toxicity question. And so we have some key questions here. Does a CEC pose human or ecological health effects? Does it pose toxicity at lower levels than previously known? Does it pose toxicity via exposure routes not previously identified? So you, being a very good program manager, do some Googling and searching in different databases. You can use our fact sheet to see where to look if you're not sure. And let's say that here's what you found. California EPA has some information on this particular chemical. We find that exposure can occur by passing from a mother to a baby during pregnancy. It can be exposure through inhalation and skin contact, and is a likely human carcinogen. You also find information in the European database through ECHA. That it's suspected of causing cancer, it's suspected of damaging fertility or an unborn child. It can cause serious eye irritation and may cause an allergic skin reaction or skin irritation. You might also find through the REACH database that it's toxic to aquatic life with long-lasting effects and is hazardous to terrestrial organisms. Okay, so that's the information. We also fortunately get some values here. We have a chronic reference dose, an RFD there. We have a cancer slope factor. Note that the cancer slope factor is for inhalation. We have some chronic information, a chronic reference concentration, and we have an inhalation unit risk factor. So I'll add that right now we based on what we found, there is no report of bioaccumulation. And of course, we have that toxicity to fish. And of course, that would then could be indirect to human consumers of those fish. Okay, so a lot of information. Let's look at what we have and through the questions. Number one, does the CEC pose human and/or ecological health effects of concern? Based on what we provided, what do you think? Just answer to yourself. I believe we can say that we have a yes there. Does the CEC pose toxicity at lower levels than previously known? You can think about what I presented. And the answer is unknown. We really didn't find anything about that. Does the CEC pose toxicity via exposure routes not previously identified? Now, this is interesting. It's a potential, right? We had an inhalation factor, but we have drinking going on. So, something about inhalation, but maybe now we might have exposure through ingestion. Okay. So, what were some gaps? Because there were some things that are clearly missing. We don't have non-cancer endpoints. We did have some about skin irritation and reproductive developmental effects. So we had some of that. We would need further characterization of the site, soil, and ambient air. We need to cover that. For those who have much more deeper understanding of toxicity value generation, it's a possibility of extrapolating maybe from the inhalation value. And that would need to be further evaluated, but could be, I understand that that could be done. To understand the direct effects to aquatic species and indirect risks to fish consumers, we would need additional data on ecological impacts and studies in order to understand that. Okay, so, and then we ask ourselves, is the data sufficient? Should we go on? So data sufficiency. And I should mention it, you know, data sufficiency asks some questions like, was the method used adequate? And we're going to talk about those kind of methods later on today. Are data of sufficient quantity and quality? Are the results reproducible? What kind of media are data available for? Are there sufficient quality assurance, quality control samples to validate the data? Were data collected using and following proper standards and guidelines? Were there enough samples collected to indicate the presence of the substance in the environment? So these are the kinds of data sufficiency questions that we encourage you to consider. If you feel like the data is really woefully insufficient, you would, of course, need to try to fill those data gaps. If you have enough data at this juncture based on your program to keep going, then we can go to the next step. You can also say that based on what we have, preliminary risk characterization is possible. We have the detection of potential CC levels in groundwater can be evaluated against cancer-based drinking water screening level or criteria. Okay, so you can ask yourself, hey, do we have enough? I think because of our case study, we're going to say, hey, we do have enough so we can take you through all these steps. But it does appear sufficient and indicative enough of a need to keep going with our prioritization. Okay, so, and then the third one is physical chemical properties to inform fate and transport. There are a number of questions to consider here, such as, is the CEC persistent? Is it bioaccumulative? Is it mobile? Does it show the potential for toxic degradation products? Does it show the potential for cross-media transfers? Are there other kinds of properties of concern? So let's say you do your due diligence and you find some information on this particular chemical, including, of course, some key physical data. We do have some information on its solubility, on its octanol water partition coefficient. So these might be helpful to think through further situations for this chemical. But clearly, we would need a lot more to answer all those questions. And so this is where professional judgment is needed. If you might determine that you had enough information on occurrence, have enough information on toxicity, that this would be additive, but it wouldn't preclude you from putting this into one of the prioritization bins. So again, professional judgment is really key here. Okay, so we're gonna come to our final determination here. How would you prioritize this chemical? Would you put it as a low, a medium, or a high? So I'm going to give a chance for people to go ahead and answer that. Okay. 10 more seconds. Okay, Devin, I think we can close the poll. And we have some answers. Okay, we had some lows. We had lots of mediums, and we have some that provided a high. So thank you for participating. This is really helpful. So before we go, there isn't a right one answer here. And that's really an important point. You have to evaluate this to your own program, whatever your program that you're involved with. You have to evaluate these things against your program's requirements and use your professional judgment. This is meant to guide you through a process to make sure it's logical, meaningful, it points you in the right direction for resources, and gives you a way to sort of put things in bins for yourself when there can be an overwhelming situation of a CEC and the uncertainties around it. Based on what our team sort of thought about this particular case study was, drum roll please, Oops. Sorry. Think I went too fast. Okay. Okay, here we go. Ta-da, medium. So, looks like many of you also agreed that maybe this would be good as a medium. And let me, just because I skipped that slide, just a reminder. As I said, data sufficiency, if you're missing something, you need to fill it in. You can classify as a medium if you think you need more information. You cannot rule out a high, or if you think you have enough to classify as a high, you can do that. Okay. So again, not the one right answer, but it looks like it was a common answer for a majority of you. That does not discount the other sort of things about where you may have landed. So yeah, this one seems to point that we need additional information. A couple of you sense that things were of concern enough that you would could you know make this high, and that's great. You need to do that, but there is some team some key data gaps that would need to be filled. Again, high priority evaluated need expanded monitoring. More a widespread and significant concern, maybe potential rulemaking. Medium is we really need to fill something before we put it low or high. So a few things that went into that. It was found in drinking water, hazardous substance, volatile, soluble, occurrence in other environmental media would need to be considered in non-cancer effects. So, what does this mean for communicating? We're going to have a much more in-depth presentation about communicating, but we just want to highlight here. When you're communicating about a medium priority, there may be some challenges with that. So you have to maybe consider your internal audience within your organization. How might you need to advocate or deal with this? You may have challenges with budgets. Trying to get a leader's attention on this. So one thing you can do often is maybe try to advocate for continuing data as the medium suggests, or even expanding, maybe developing recommendations and a communication plan. You may need to focus on susceptible populations if that's an issue there. So these are just some ideas where you can promote action. And then, of course, ways to reduce outrage internally. Communicate to decision makers about the need for more information and the steps that are being taken to protect impacted populations. Externally, communicating known risks, particularly impacted subgroups. We're going to talk more about that. Of course, review and update information as it becomes available and can continue to communicate changes with honesty, transparency, and empathy. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our case study. To say thank you for playing. I think we're going to move to back to our moderator for some Q&A. Is that right?
It is indeed. Thank you very much,
Okay.
Jose. All
Wonderful.
right. So as Jose mentioned, we're going to step into our first Q&A break here. Just to be conscious of time, we're going to jump right into the questions that are in our Q&A pod. If you have a question and haven't submitted it yet, feel free to do so. And just as a reminder, we will have one more Q&A break at the end of our modules today. All right, trainers, our first question. What specific criteria must be met to classify as a CEC? Availability of analytical methods, bioaccumulation, toxicology, exposure, occurrence, risk assessment, things, those are just some examples.
I think a bunch of us could answer this. I'll start. I think our goal is to not be like, this is all the things we're not dictating how you might call a CEC. I think Kim at the beginning covered those key things about a CEC, some of the uncertainties that it's contaminant, it's emerging, it's of concern. Don't know if any of my other colleagues want to weigh in on that.
I think you went beyond Jose and outlined just through the kind of the checklist of questions that need to be asked because as you also stressed, every every situation, every site, every evaluation, every, state and their regulations are different. So it's, it's not a one size fits all, and the framework is really designed to be malleable, and used by, a range of different programs with different capacities to evaluate CECs.
Thank you, Kim and Jose. So within that strain, we've had a few questions asking about how microplastics fit into CECs. And I was wondering, Jose, I know you're applied in the chat, but if you could touch on that perhaps for our audience.
I think it was it Vivek? Were you talking about the microplastics
Oh, I'm
issue?
sorry. It was not
No, that's
Jose, it
okay.
was Farouk. It was Vivek. Apologies. Farouk, if you're able to talk about microplastics.
Sure. Sure. So microplastics, as far as analysis goes, concerns not only the detection of the material itself, which is typically done by infrared spectroscopy, but it also involves the analysis of contaminants that may be sorbed on to that particle. And some of the toxicological features of microplastics, they derive from both the size of the particle as well as, the material that may be sorbed on. So it's different than individual chemicals as such. And I think as far as analytical methods go, we covered in our particulates section together with engineered nanoparticles.
Thank you.
And if I could just add on to that, Devin, I'm sending to Devin the link that she can share with the audience, the link to ITRC's microplastics guidance document, which has a wealth of information, including some analytical methods. So hopefully that can serve as a useful reference as well.
You beat me to it, Kim. I was just about to do a plug for our microplastics team. So I did put that in the chat and encourage everybody to look at it. There's lots of great information. All right, next question. Who pays for the initial CEC evaluation?
Well,
No help.
I'll just take a first stab at that. So, as it was, stressed a couple times, this guidance is really developed for state regulatory agencies. So, in this framework, it's really intended for kind of state agencies that are doing the evaluation. So, in this case, states, through their resources and staffing would be conducting the initial evaluations. If I'm not sure if that answers the question posed, but that's how I see it just in this framework.
Thank you, Kim. And Kim, this is a question specifically to you. Why is radiological material not included? What type of biological CECs are now considered? Are they a part of the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, NPDES, under the Clean Water Act?
So radiologicals were outside the scope of this team's work. This team really focused on chemical CECs. And I'm going to make another plug. Stay tuned because there is a CEC 2.0 team that has just started that is formed to specifically address biologicals. The team has had only one meeting, so if you are interested, please go to the ITRC website. Hopefully, Devin can include a link to take you directly to the new CEC team page so you can join. You are actively invited to join the team. We are still recruiting and are looking for people interested and with expertise in biologicals. But that is something the team is still trying to chart out as far as what exactly the scope is in addressing biological CECs. So stay tuned. There is definitely a lot more to come on that front.
Thank you, Kim. And I did put the link for the biologicals team in the chat here for everybody, and we do encourage you to check it out. All right, our next question. Can you talk about CEC specific to wastewater solid matrix like sludge?
And what I would say is, the example we had, there was a detection in wastewater. It was not in sludge, but you could still use the framework because you're going to ask yourself the key questions of, is there an exposure route? Is it occurring in a way that's exposing human or ecological endpoints? So these are still the same sort of critical questions that you would ask through that medium, through that pathway. And then, of course, moving on to the same questions that followed, looking at the toxicity effects and then particular properties. So I think it could be definitely used for a contaminant like that.
Thank you, Jose. All right, next question. Are CECs a subset of unregulated contaminants, or do the definitions of CECs and UCs differentiate them from each other?
Sure, how to answer that one. I know the sort of
Well,
ACMR. Yeah, go for
I'll just say
it,
I'll take the first stab.
Kim.
I guess I would agree that CECs are not regulated. So how you want to define things from there might be splitting hairs. They're unregulated, they're emerging, and it's just as Jose kind of went through, there's a range of how much is known or not known about them. All
Perfect.
right, thank you. Next question. What is the advantage of classifying something as a CEC from the regulatory perspective? This person gave an example of California would allow adding such chemicals to the Proposition 65 list. But if you could perhaps give some of your experiences, that would be helpful.
I'll provide one, which was covered early in the intro, as far as potentially allowing or opening states up to applying for federal funding to address those CECs. So, that's certainly one big advantage to doing that, to applying for funding to support additional monitoring or evaluation of CECs. I don't know if anyone else has other things to add to that.
Hi. So Kim, to add on to yours, the building and infrastructure law, specifically there's funding for drinking water projects and wastewater projects pertaining to CEC. So that's a specific regarding getting federal funding. And I
Well,
could include the link to the specific page that discusses CEC and that law.
you want to put it in our trainer chat, Carol? I'll put it
Yes.
out for the larger audience. All right. Thank you, Carol and Kim. Next question. Would you consider a known contaminant that has already had a site screening value as a CEC? At what point would you say a particular contaminant is classified as such?
Hey, thanks for the question. And I would say one thing I'd sort of emphasize is that it's something that you consider based on your own program. That E is so critical. Something emerges. It emerges for a number of reasons, but one can be that there's new information about its exposure, its properties we didn't realize, or toxicity through exposure routes that were not previously characterized. So it is possible to have something where there is information or there is a screening level, and then suddenly you find out something else that didn't fit into that original assessment, and that you need to consider something else. So things can become CEC, meaning they emerge, they're a concern, they need to be reevaluated because of new information.
All right, thank you. All right, at this time, we are going to look back to our content and our webinar slides here, and then we will have one more live train, excuse me, live question and answer period at the end of our sections. So up next, we have here, Jose, one second. Let me take the remote control back slide for Farouk. All right, up next, I believe that we have Farouk with the identification of analytical methods.
Sorry, let me take myself off of mute.
No worries. All right. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Oops, okay. Just a second. Ah, there you go. Okay, so the next part of this training deals with adoption of analytical methods for identifying CEC. I encourage you to go online and look at the fact sheet. It has a lot of pertinent information. And the main question as far as this training is concerned, we're trying to talk about how do you identify an emerging contaminant in environmental media. Okay, so just to give you a scope of the fact sheet, it has four sections. We focus on chemical compound analysis as the first, and then move on to chemical classes using PFAS as an example. And we also cover biological contaminants or pathogens. And then the final section is about particulates, and these are microplastics and engineered nanoparticles. There are a number of resources. These are all online and all will be part of the PDF version of the document, and these include like online resources at the end of each one of these sections. There's a glossary of terms, so in case you're reading through and don't know what something means, you can look that up. And also an acronyms list is available as well. And now the focus of the training today is primarily on individual chemical compound analysis. We'll briefly touch upon the other sections, but the focus today is on the first part. Excuse me. So when you think about broadly about the emerging contaminant problem, it is essentially a transient problem. So initially, you know, very little is known about, you know, what it is, what are the full scope of its effects. So it falls into this quadrant of unknown unknown. So here I'm using for known and unknown, these two terms, I'm using the identity of the substance. And then the second thing is its effects. And in this sort of a situation, as you learn more and more about it, you know, you move on to another quadrant where you can, you know, have a better idea of what the identity of that substance is. And then finally, you know, you have developed methods, and then you can easily identify and quantify the substance in environmental media. So this arc of, you know, diminishing uncertainty is very characteristic of a CEC problem. And this arc can be mapped onto this four-quadrant structure, which is known as the matrix of knowns and unknowns. Okay, for some reason my slide is not moving. Okay, sorry. Let me just go back. I apologize. A little slower. Okay, so when you're actually trying to analyze a CEC, you start off the other way. Essentially, this arc goes the other way. You start off with everything that's available to you. So it's a process of elimination. You employ targeted analysis methods. So these are based on reference compounds and reference spectra. This, an example of this would be the, you know, SW846 compendium methods. And these would give you the identity and also the quantity of the substance in environmental media. However, if you don't have reference materials, if you don't have a calibration standard that you can use, you move into the next part of it where you're trying to, you can still identify it, but you won't know its quantity. So you move into the suspect screening area, where there could be a list of suspect compounds, perhaps based on the material that was spilled, so from its composition, or perhaps a process from which a release occurred. So you can have a suspect list, and you can acquire those substances, even though they are not known environmental contaminants, and then analyze for them in your unknown, as an unknown in your sample. Now, if you have nothing, no reference materials at all, you don't have a reference spectrum, you don't have the calibration standard, then you move into a very exploratory sort of a technique known as on-target analysis. And here you're trying to identify something using an instrument commonly known as a high-resolution mass spectrometer. So this will give you a molecular formula for your compound, and that is typically what is used. But the key point here is that you have to exhaust all things that are already available to you, or like established targeted analysis methods, before you move on to a more exploratory type of analysis. Okay, as part of this training, we have two case studies. The first case study starts off with a target analysis run where an unknown peak is found, and then how do you go about determining its identity and developing a method for it. And this is essentially the same compound that was covered in the key variables fact sheet. And basically, we're going to talk about the analytical portion of that case study. The second case study deals with non-target analysis. So in this case, the all targeted analysis methods have been exhausted. Suspect lists have been created and analyzed for, and this compound cannot be identified. So then you have to move on to something known as non-target analysis using high-resolution mass spectrometry. And you can think, what possible things could sort of fall into that category. So things like transformation products, which have not been known before, or impurities and mixtures which are not purified and sort of don't have any kind of reference standards. So that's the sort of thing that would fall into that area. So the reference materials for identifying compounds and also quantifying them is a key factor in developing analytical methods. And here, I've changed the two terms slightly, where the known and unknown or known known. The first term refers to the spectrum, whereas the second term refers to the actual calibration or reference analytical standard. And when you have both of these available, you can run your targeted screening or targeted analysis method. You can identify the compound by matching the unknown spectrum to a spectral library of the target analytes. So you get an identity confirmation, and then you have a calibration standard that you've used to develop a calibration curve or a response factor, so you can quantify it as well. Now, if there is no reference standard available, you move into these two other areas. You may still be able to identify this compound if there is a spectrum available for it in a reference spectral library. So this would be more of a suspect screening type of analysis. And then if you have no reference materials, like you cannot find this material's spectrum in any kind of reference library, and there's no standard available, then it falls into the area of non-targeted screening. And here we would rely on this high-resolution mass spectrometry to get the molecular formula using accurate mass. Okay, so this brings us to our first case study. It's the same compound, and I'd like you to ignore the answer on the right in that little box there. And the scenario for this, as Jose earlier described, is that a GCMS method, since this compound is a semi-volatile, so it would be 8270C that was run, and a new peak was found in the environmental sample. And the GCMS method was run in full scan mode, so it's detecting everything that's coming off the chromatogram. And the first match against the reference spectral library for all the target analytes did not yield any kind of match. So then what do? You move on to the next phase. You op open this the spectral match of this unknown peak to a wider library. So every GCMS instrument comes sort of its computer comes loaded with this spectral library known as the Wiley-NIST library. It has roughly 1.2 million compounds as of 2023. And it's essentially all compounds that are manufactured or that have been identified in the past. And if you run it against that, the wider spectral library, the person got an 85% or higher match, and that threshold identifies that compound or categorizes that compound as a tentatively identified compound. So you have a partial match or a fairly significant match, and then you can go looking for this compound in through various vendors. Fortunately, this compound is available as Jose described because it's used as a solvent and also an intermediate compound in various chemical manufacturing processes. So you can acquire that from any kind of vendor like Sigma-Aldrich, and then develop its calibration curve, store its spectrum, and then match your unknown peak against this particular compound. And lo and behold, you get a good match, and then you modify your existing 8270C method, so it becomes 8270C modified. And then you can characterize, identify, and sort of quantify this compound in your environmental samples. So this is a fairly straightforward process. You might be asking, why can't I do this for everything? And the key term here, I mentioned this was a semi-volatile, hence we're using a GCMS method, is the gas chromatography part. So the compound would have to be volatile or semi-volatile. And also, it would have to be non-thermally labile, and that term means that it doesn't break down upon heating. So, as most of you might know, GC runs on a thermal gradient, and as you heat up the column, there are certain substances that can break down. So, for that kind of setup, you need to run LC-MS. And in the next slide, we'll discuss why LC-MS libraries are not quite as reliable as GC-MS libraries. So here's the difference between the chromatography and the mass spectrometry. There's an interface for ionization. Now, GCMS uses what's known as electron ionization or electron impact ionization. It's a very strong ionization technique. It has an energy of 70 electron volts or higher. So it basically breaks down the molecule that's eluting off the chromatograph into as many possible fragments that it can be broken down to. And hence, it has a very high ionization efficiency. So ionization efficiency, if you look at the bottom of the slide, is proportional to the number of ions generated for a number of molecules consumed. It's very reliable. If you look at the little curve on the right, it's basically where the current from the mass spectrometer plateaus. So it's consistent. So remember that what the mass spectrometer is analyzing is fragments. So these are charged fragments. They're traveling in an electric field, so they produce a current. And so for a GCMS electron ionization sort of a setup, you have a fairly constant current. And this current is sort of tolerant, and this sort of fragmentation is tolerant of any kind of matrix effects. And it's highly reproducible. So you can have spectra that are highly reproducible on different platforms, different instruments, for different matrices. And hence, it yields a platform-independent reference spectral library, like the Wiley-NIST library. It's highly reliable, doesn't matter which instrument you have. you can run this and get a good match. Now, for an LC-MS, you have a lot more carrier fluid, basically in the form of a liquid coming off. So you have to basically evaporate a lot of that solvent that's coming with your target molecule, and hence a more softer ionization technique results. This is known as ESI or electrospray ionization, and it falls somewhere in the curve where there is in the sharps in the steep part of the curve. So small things like matrix interferences, different platforms of analysis, so maybe LC-MSs from different manufacturers, things like that can put this in a different part of the curve, and hence you have highly variable fragmentation. So typically for LC-MS spectral libraries, these are developed by acquiring standards and developing them in-house. There are a few spectral libraries that are available for LC-MS. These are for LC-tandem-MS, but still, when you use them, these need to be normalized based on the instrument and the conditions that you're using it for. So by acquiring some sort of a reference calibration standard. Now you can sort of circumvent both of these by using, if you don't have a spectral library, if you don't have a calibration standard, you can move on to a non-targeted analysis using high-resolution mass spectrometry. So examples of high-resolution mass spectrometers are QTOF, so that's a quadrupole time-of-flight mass spectrometer. It's also the FTICR or Fourier transform ion cyclotron resonance mass spectrometer. A cruder version of that is the Orbitrap, available from a couple of vendors. So these type of instruments give you a highly accurate mass. So as you see, the nominal mass, which is essentially giving you unit resolution, would only be these numbers here in this column. However, if you have a high-resolution mass spectrometer, you can get measurement up to three or more decimal places. So, for example, if you have a nominal mass on an older mass spectrometer, like a single quad, you may see just the peak that comes out is like a 60 mass per charge ratio, and that can correspond to all four of these compounds. However, if you have a high-resolution instrument, it goes down to third decimal place or more, and at that point, you can deduce the identity of the molecule that's unknown, based on the sensitivity of this instrument. So that's roughly how it works. Excuse me. There's also something known as a Shemansky scale. It's basically a scale for assigning confidence in the identification via high-resolution mass spectrometry. The example that I showed you on the previous slide falls at the level five, sort of a level five confidence level, where you have an exact mass of interest that you've identified. You can further, as you know, there are stable isotopes for the different elements. So, if you have variations in stable isotope ratios or stable isotopes, you account for that, then you can move on to the level four identification or confidence level. And then you can also supplement this with MS squared, means basically a tandem mass spectrometer. So any kind of fragmentation pattern that you can get from your by fragmenting your molecular ion peak, which is the MS. Additionally, you can also have experimental data. By experimental data, we mean here a software that actually predicts spectra based on the ionization energy. So these examples of these would be like METFRAG, and there are other tools, other software tools as well. So you can supplement this into this confidence scheme, or not a confidence scheme, but confidence signing scheme. And eventually you can get a level one confirmed structure. If you have a reference standard that from which you can get the retention time of the chromatograph, you can get the molecular ion peak at high resolution, and then also the fragmented B. So let's see how this works. So next we have the second case study. This is based on a paper by Yin et al. In, I believe, in 2021 in the journal Science. And it talks about the urban runoff mortality syndrome, essentially a phenomenon that's observed in acute, results in acute mortality in coho salmon. It was first observed in the Pacific Northwest, where salmon farming, obviously, and is a major industry. And what was observed was that it occurs annually when the coho salmon return to spawn in fresh waters located in urbanized watersheds. And also another observation was that it occurs during and following rainfall runoff events. Now, these investigators had prior research work that deduced sort of the identity of, or to somewhat deduce the identity of what might be causing this problem. And they localized it to tire treadwear particle leachate. So it's essentially treadwear on a roadway where you have rain picks up a lot of these materials. And this TWPL is essentially a complex aqueous leachate of all the tire products that might be found on a roadway. And essentially this complex leachate was able to induce that sort of mortality in coho salmon in the lab. All targeted methods were exhausted by the researchers, and also suspect lists were made based on the materials used in tire manufacturing. These were analyzed and these were exhausted, and no identity could be determined for this compound. So these researchers employed a sort of a three-part experimental protocol. The first part involved simplifying this mixture. So remember, I told you that the TWPL is a complex mixture, a complex aqueous mixture. So they simplified or basically broke it down into multiple parts and tested the toxicity of each part or fraction. And if it was not toxic to the subject fish, it was discarded. If it was toxic, then that fraction was kept. And it was subjected to high-resolution mass spectrometry coupled with ultra-high-performance liquid chromatography. And once the chemical features or peaks were obtained from this type of analysis for the fraction that was toxic, these features were pooled and prioritized. Okay. So again, this is the three-part setup. Again, it's turned on its side. You know, you have the mixture simplification. This was done by chromatography. If you think about a 10-minute run through each one of these, then each one of these white dots is a minute long fraction, and you use different stationary phase media to essentially give you different subgroups or subparts of this mixture, and each one of these fractions was tested for toxicity. And so then in the first preparation, the fraction 6 turned out to be toxic, similar to the second fraction to the second prep procedure. And then for the last one, it was fraction number 4. These were all subjected to UHPLC, HRMS, and the common peaks were pooled. And there were only 4 peaks in the positive ionization mode and only 3 in the negative ionization mode. The peak that was most prominent was the C18, H22, N2O2. Actually, it's C18H23N2O2 because there is a proton added onto it. It had a mass of 299.1752 using high-resolution mass spectrometry. Once you know these guys had a target, they could further purify this mixture. They put all 3 of these columns in series, tested for which part of the elution was giving you this peak, and then collected that fraction and then beautified it further. And that particular peak, once you subtract out the proton, corresponded to the Cd18, H22, N2O2. So this would be, what we talked about on our confidence scale, would be a Shemansky level 5 or higher identification of the CEC. Now, the reason why I say it's going to be higher is because the HRMS confidence scale by Shemansky does not account for toxicity testing. So here we have, we have corresponding evidence that shows that this particular substance is toxic to the salmon. Now, through additional testing and also additional analytical methodologies like FDIR, NMR, the structure of the compound was determined. And at this level, since we still don't have a calibration standard, it was determined to be 6 ppdq. And this would be a Shemansky level 3 or higher prediction. Again, remember that we are doing toxicity testing as well. And this product itself is a quinone product of 6 ppd, which is a tire anti-degradant. It reacts with ozone and forms this new compound and has these two extra O's and becomes toxic to the receptor. So this is roughly how this process works. Now, I mean, stepping back and looking at the entire CEC analytical life cycle, we've covered tick identification or tentatively identified compound identification by spectral library matching. That was our first case study. And then we looked at non-target analysis using high-resolution mass spectrometry coupled with effect-directed analysis. That was our 6 ppd study. Now, once we know the identity of the compound, we can, as I mentioned to you in the first case study, you can simply purchase it if it is commercially available. And then you can develop your, you can store the spectrum, you can develop your calibration curve. There may be instances where, in the case of 6 ppdq, where you have to actually synthesize the compound. So there are specialty chemical reference material vendors. They can actually synthesize the compound and then purify it and give you some sort of characterization data of the compound. And as demand for detecting this compound becomes more prevalent, there could be mass production of the chemical. Now, once you have the targeted, the next phase of this, once you've acquired the substance, is to develop the targeted instrumental method. So both the spectrum and the calibration or reference or response factor. And this would involve, dealing with things like method detection limits, any kind of QA/QC protocols, such as matrix interferences and other factors, any kind of field sampling issues in case your emerging contaminant is reacting with any kind of sampling material. And then once this draft method is developed, it is sent for multi-lab validation where different labs try to validate this method. And once it's validated, it will become a targeted instrumental, a targeted analytical method. Okay, so the last slide was the last part of the individual chemical analysis. Now, PFAS is an interesting substance because, as you might know, there's the last sort of last count was around 9,000 different compounds. So for PFAS, there are target screening methods. A few of them are listed here. And if you look at the individual compounds that are analyzed through these targeted methods, there's roughly about 45 to 47. So with certainty, we can send our sample to the commercial lab and they can analyze for these 45 to 47 compounds because they are part of the target analyte list of one of these methods. In addition, you can also, certain commercial labs have additional standards for specific PFAS. So the hard number is somewhere between 90 to 100 of compounds that you can identify. After that, just to get your hands around the scope of the problem, there are methods for chemical glass analysis. And the reason why these are important is that, PFAS toxicity is perceived to be similar across its entire chemical class. And hence, you have methods such as the US EPA draft method 1621, which is the adsorbable or extractable organic fluorine method via combustion ion chromatography. So it employs basically sorbing on the PFAS compounds or the organic fluorine compounds onto a solid matrix or some sort of extracting solution, and then combusting it and then analyzing the fluoride ion. There's also the other method, and this is partially targeted because you essentially analyze your sample prior to conducting this method using one of these methods, and then you subject it to hydroxyl ion oxidation, and this is known as the TOP assay or total oxidizable precursor assay. And once your unknowns are further oxidized into one of these compounds on the target analyte list, you can rerun the sample and see how much more of these known compounds were produced. So these are the two methods that are actually available through commercial labs. And in addition, there's also non-target or suspect screening analysis for PFAS, so ALCHRMS methods, very similar to what we discussed as in the Shemansky scale. There is actually a confidence scale for PFAS. It's further stratified than the Shemansky scale, and it takes advantage of things like fragmentation patterns that you see for homologous series for PFAS. So homologous series, for example, would be all alkanes are in a homologous series, so they have a certain fragmentation pattern. So you can also do suspect screening and non-target screening using LCHRMS for PFAS. Okay, so that was chemical class analysis, and then the analytical methods fact sheet also covers pathogens or biological CECs, and it builds on the ITRC's prior product, the EMD fact sheet or the Environmental Molecular Diagnostics fact sheet that came in, was released in 2013. That fact sheet focused more on organisms involved in bioremediation. Here we're focusing on pathogens, and just as a note, this has been taken up by the ITRC CEC Biologicals team, so this will be further expanded upon. And there'll be additional case studies developed for things like, hopefully for things like COVID or something else. And finally, there's a section within the fact sheet that deals with particulates analysis, and that it focuses on microplastics and engineered nanoparticles. The microplastics part is essentially a summary of the analytical portion of the fact sheet for microplastics that's available online from ITRC. And the new material here is the engineered nanoparticles analysis. I think that brings us to the end of our fact sheet. And the next part is the risk communication, which will be communicated by my colleague here, Megan Sabari, from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Farouk. So in this fact sheet, we're going to talk about how to communicate information on CECs to the public and stakeholders in a timely fashion, some risk communication basics, communication considerations and challenges, and then also some lessons learned. One moment here. Okay. So once our agency has set a priority level for a CEC using the process that we just discussed, it will be important to start using risk communication techniques with your stakeholders, whether they're internal or external of your agency. I'll share some great resources that go in depth on risk communications in a short while, but we'll start with some basics here just to make sure we're all in the same place. The overall goal of risk communications is to educate people about a risk to allow them to make informed decisions to protect themselves. To successfully accomplish that goal, you need to communicate the available information in a way that is accessible to the unique audience you're trying to reach. For example, you wouldn't reach elderly adults by creating content on TikTok, nor would you reach Gen Z with messaging through the local news. The process for developing risk communication materials includes identifying and understanding your audience and stakeholders, and then engaging them in ways that are appropriate for each unique audience. It requires identifying your specific goals at different points during the communication process, understanding the concerns and perceptions of the unique audience, and then developing clear messages and pathways to reach it. You may develop the perfect message, but without understanding how to deliver the message to the audience in a way in which it will be received, you might as well be shouting into the wind. Additionally, risk communications are a two-way process where you adapt messaging by listening to and learning from the audience about their concerns. Particularly with situations involving CECs, you may need to encourage decision makers in your agency to share information with the public before they feel completely comfortable doing so. While waiting until you have solid information to share is ideal, you also need to be aware of the possibility of misinformation taking hold within your audience if you aren't communicating in a timely manner. The uncertainty surrounding CECs means messages may come from different places or sources, may urge different levels of action, and may ultimately cause confusion, distrust, and frustration in the public. Each entity that completes the prioritization process will establish a priority level that is unique to them. Differences in ecological and environmental aspects, social desire, and political commitment will impact the priority level and the actions taken to address CECs. Additionally, entities may use different data sources or interpret data differently during the risk assessment. For example, one entity could be looking at occupational exposure, while another is looking at incidental exposure. There is also the question of what level of known data is enough to develop recommendations. All of these differences will impact your messaging, which is also based on not only the scientific calculations, but the politics and level of media and community attention. Ultimately, with all these differences, an additional challenge with communicating risk from CECs could be your audience receiving different messages from different sources. So there are many definitions of risk, as well as perspectives about what is risky. To a risk assessment professional, risk is based on a mathematical function that takes into account the consequences and likelihood of something happening. As such, it is measured objectively. For example, health standards for a compound that were developed based on data from scientific studies to a general member of the community, risk will likely be something much more ambiguous based on their experiences, fears, or other subjective factors. For example, an individual making a choice between organic or conventional produce. Effective risk communication requires understanding both objective and subjective viewpoints. For example, a community may have recently discovered PFAS in their municipal drinking water at levels below health standards. Your message could be that there's low risk to drinking the water, and here are steps you can take to reduce your exposure if you would like to take additional actions. One additional challenge with risk communication is that each collective audience is comprised of individuals who have their own concerns that may be collectively similar for some aspects, but different for others. By talking with and learning from your audience, you will be better able to address their unique concerns collectively. There are two approaches for communicating risk based on your overall goal. The first, precaution advocacy, encourages individuals to take actions to reduce risk. Examples of precaution advocacy include campaigns to reduce smoking or encourage radon testing in homes. The second, outrage management, has a goal of calming stakeholder concern when it is disproportionate to the level of risk determined by available data. Examples include situations where a community is concerned about potential pollution sources, but data shows the pollution has a limited impact. In these situations, it is important to be empathetic to the individuals or community's concerns because without empathy, you may appear condescending or that you're blowing off their concerns, which could cause you to lose your audience. Regardless of which approach is needed for the specific situation, it is necessary to build trust with your audience by being honest with them, transparent about the situation, and empathetic to their concerns. Trust takes time to build, but can be easily broken. Without trust, your audience will be unreceptive to the message you're trying to communicate, which will make them less likely to follow your recommendations. So let's go deeper into precaution advocacy. As previously mentioned, this is encouraging your stakeholders or audience to take action. The message here being, do something. It's important to note that early on in particular, your internal stakeholders or decision makers may be the audience here. Don't think that the only people that need risk communication skills are the organizational spokespersons and public information officers. Subject matter experts may find themselves trying to convince the organization to provide additional resources to properly identify or categorize a CEC. Of course, as a CEC moves towards a higher priority and you have more information on negative human or environmental effects, you will want to let the public know about the risk so they can take action. The level of difficulty of your job as a risk communicator, particularly when dealing with the public, will depend on the overall situation and your audience's starting point. A useful way to visualize the starting point is with the precaution adoption process model. This is a series of general stages in your audience's decision process. Knowing roughly where they are on the list will help you tailor your message. For example, people who are unaware of an issue or unengaged may need basic education in order to recognize the need to take action. People who have already decided to act probably need less basic education and more guidance as to how they can protect themselves. Because I know you're going to ask, here are some suggested starting points when you're trying to get people to do things they may not be inclined to do. First, and especially if people are in stages one or two of the precaution adoption process model, they are not very interested in the issue. You need to get their attention, and even when you have it, you probably won't have it for long. Keep your message concise and interesting. Second, stay on message. Keep pushing the same short and interesting message until it sinks in. Third, don't hesitate to appeal to emotions. I don't mean that you should rely exclusively on emotion at the expense of data, but emotions are a very powerful motivator in most people. You can use that to your advantage. And finally, give people things to do if it makes sense for the situation. Allow them to feel that they are doing something to take control rather than waiting on the world to change for them. Bottom line, if this is beginning to sound like traditional advertising, that's basically what it is. The next likely scenario you will face with a CEC is when stakeholders are genuinely upset or alarmed about the situation, and your job is to reduce their concern to a level consistent with the actual hazard. If the message in precaution advocacy is do something, the message here is calm down. However, I don't recommend using the words calm down when someone is upset. It's likely to work about as well as the last time you said it to your significant other during an argument. I know I've ended up even more upset when I've been told to calm down. Nevertheless, the goal is to get the audience to calm down. So this can be tricky when your stakeholders are stressed or directing their anger about the situation at you. They have more difficulty processing information, particularly when the information is made of large complex words like per and polyfluoroalkyl alkyl substances. They may convince themselves that the sky is falling and may get defensive when you try to convince them otherwise. It can be a tricky situation to navigate. Okay, so what are some strategies to handle the inevitable public outrage when a CEC turns up in the news? First, stake out the middle. What I mean by that is to acknowledge that the other side has a point, even if the other side is insisting that the worst case interpretation is the only possible one. This does a couple of things for you. First, you are validating your audience by letting them know that they are not foolish because of their concerns. You're not validating their interpretation, but you are invalidating them as individuals that have understandable concerns. After all, you want to start where your audience is and not where you would prefer them to be. Second, taking an extreme, everything is perfectly safe position will inevitably lose. Humans evolved to be cautious. People who assumed the saber-toothed tiger wanted to eat them and acted accordingly survived. Those who thought the little kitty just wanted to play didn't. Similarly, in a situation between there is massive danger and there is zero danger, massive danger wins every time. In massive danger versus a little bit of danger, a little bit of danger has a chance. Second, acknowledge problems. In terms of CECs, this is often going to be the uncertainty involved. It is true that people do not like uncertainty, but if you start by pointing out that things are very likely to change and that the information you have now is the best available, changing your advice or even your position down the road will not reflect as badly on you as a messenger. Considering your position with no forewarning, or worse, no acknowledgement that you ever had a different position, will almost certainly lead your audience to conclude that you are not to be trusted. If your job as a risk communicator is to try changing minds, being considered untrustworthy by your audience is going to make your job much harder. While each situation will have different challenges, here are some best practices to keep in mind while communicating CECs. Since each situation is different, tailor your message to your communication goal as well as to the specific audience you're trying to reach. Your message and process for educating people about a lower risk situation will be different than the message and process used if you're urging immediate actions. Your message and goals will likely change throughout the CEC lifecycle as well. There are great resources available for risk communication that will help you identify very specific audiences and hone the message you want to communicate to that audience. By their very nature, emerging contaminants will have changing information that need to be communicated. As such, update your audience as frequently as possible with transparent messaging to avoid the impression that you are hiding information. People will seek answers to their questions. If you aren't providing trusted information, others will fill that void. Can you trust the information being provided by other sources as accurate? In changing situations, it can be difficult to provide consistent and understandable messaging. The communicator may be concerned about looking indecisive and incompetent when presenting changing information, and may be tempted to state information as fact rather than acknowledging the uncertainty of the situation. However, the communicator's credibility, and by extension, the organization's credibility, can be damaged tremendously by presenting something as fact when the data isn't so clear. Instead, acknowledge the uncertainty in a confident manner, share what you know, where information gaps exist, and when more information can be expected. Finally, it is critical to be honest about the situation. When there is a high risk to the individual, it may be tempting to omit information, overstate the available information, or lie to influence people to make choices that you feel are correct. After all, you're doing it to protect the public, right? But the potential costs to your organization's credibility are too high and could easily end up hurting your overall goal of protecting the public from a CEC. Once trust is lost, it is difficult to regain. So as promised, here are four resources that will take you in depth into risk communications. They'll help you get started with identification of your goals and specific audiences, developing messages to help you reach your identified goals and the audiences, and considerations during communication plannings. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Devin for the next Q&A.
All right, thank you so much, Megan. I'm just going to real quick set our slides up here for our Q&A. all right, so at this time, I'm going to look to our Q&A pod for our last session of answering questions, and then I'll wrap up the webinar with some logistics. So our first question for our trainers, how do states coordinate the collection of non-target analysis data to improve database quality?
I'll take that, I guess. So that's a really good question. There is no, as far as I know, there's no current sort of mechanism to coordinate between states at this point. However, there is a what's known as a Norman network, which is a global network of labs, academia, and others that looks at high-resolution mass spectrometry and data collection through those methods. So you may want to visit that. There is it's a membership-based sort of a community. So there may be some sort of a membership fee involved with that. That's it.
All right, thank you. Next question. How e excuse me, sorry. Who is responsible for the method development of new ECE? Also, what is the process?
The process is essentially this, the slide that I showed you, sort of the life cycle slide of method development. And initially, you have to first identify the compound. That's really the critical hurdle. And once you've, and the reasons for identifying a particular emerging contaminant can be many. It could be something that may be causing some sort of a toxic effect at a human or ecological receptor. It could be media concerns. It could be other reasons, perceptions within the media and whatnot, or in the public. So there can be many factors. So the responsibility is sort of diffused, you know. So EPA obviously develops targeted methods, but you know the and it's and if there is a demand, you know, for certain labs would also attempt to identify your compounds as well. So there's no real. Remind me again, Devin, the question was just about who has the responsibility, right? So the
Yes.
responsibility is in a sort of a gray area where, you know, there really is no clear responsibility of who develops an analytical method for an emerging contaminant. The EPA will do it, but it'll be over a longer time period. If there is a need for it, for the various reasons I described before, there may be a push to develop it by the state itself. And
Right,
I should
thank you.
point out that the 6-PPD method development occurred in the state of Washington, and it's a coordination between the University of Washington and the state environmental agency.
Right, thank you for it. This next question's also for you. It references slide 52, which I'm happy to screen share for ref just to for some context. But the question is, how do you handle the unknown knowns that was referenced in the lower left-hand quadrant?
Can you go to the slide, Devin, if you
Yep,
don't
give me
mind?
1 second. I'm going to do a new screen share here.
Yeah, so that's the there's really no clear definition for analytical stuff, analytical methodology for the unknown unknowns. However, you know, the matrix of knowns and unknowns is used both in analytical chemistry and also in risk analysis. So an unknown unknown in risk analysis would be something that a substance that's known, but it may have a new effect or a new concern associated with it. In unfortunately, in analytical methodology, there's really no clear representation of that coordinate. So if you see the slide that I showed later with the arrow, that only covered these three quadrants: known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns.
All right, thank you. Next question. How is efficient messaging currently being articulated for CEC regulation? What if misinformation comes from regulated entities such as the PFAS industry, for example?
So I think this one you're never going to be able to control other people's messages. So you want to continue to put your message out there in effective ways. So it's really doing the homework to understand your audience and then just repeating that message over and over again. And also really working to build trust within that audience so that they will turn to you when they have questions rather than turning to those sources of misinformation.
Thank you. And let me just go back to the slide here. Okay. Next question. How easily are the compound references available, and do you have any insight as to the cost?
Yeah, so I mean, there's companies that provide calibration standards. You can look at their, and reference material is always expensive. By expensive, I guess that's a relative term, but certainly, you can purchase as a chemical compound itself if it's mass produced. But if not, there may be calibration standards available from various vendors. I don't want to specify any names here, but there are companies that specialize in making calibration standards. So depends, if it's just the chemical itself, then it may be anywhere from 20 to 100 or 100 to $200. It could be a mixed standard as well. However, if you need some sort of a stable isotope standard, that can be quite expensive. So it goes into a couple of $100. And those are needed for, LC tandem MS methods sometimes to get to really low detection limits. So yeah, that's why, LC-MS methods typically cost more, substantially more than GC-MS methods, for example.
All right, thank you very much. That wraps up our Q&A for our webinar today. I have put a few notes in the chat for everybody. The first is that if you have any further questions or would like clarification on any questions or answers provided today, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to get in touch with our trainers. Their information is listed on the Clue In training page that brought you here today. If you're interested in a feedback form or to let us know how the training went today, you can do so at the Clue In training page as well, where you can fill out the feedback form and then click the box to certify that you participated to get a certificate of completion. So with that, I'd just like to thank all of our attendees for joining us today, and a special thank you to our expert trainers and support for the support that they've given us for this training. So with that, I'd like to just wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and hopefully we will see you in future ITRC webinars. Trainers, thank you very much.